Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 100 for May 10th, 2011. My name is Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rabia.
And I'm David O'Brien.
We've got three stories for you this week. First, we're going to talk about Righthaven and the copyright assignments that it gets from the Las Vegas Review Journal. Second, we're going to talk about CNET being sued over LimeWire. Finally, we're going to discuss an ITC case where the judge sided with Apple in a multi-touch patent dispute. So diving right into this, our first case, and there was also a post on this on the blog last week, which we'll link in the show notes, is it's about Righthaven's copyright assignment. So we've talked about Righthaven before, and basically they're a law firm that entered into an arrangement with several news organizations whereby if Righthaven found that somebody had copied all or part of a news story, Righthaven allegedly would get a copyright assignment from the news agency, and then Righthaven would pursue a case on its own behalf, suing that the infringer for copyright infringement. And Righthaven was famous in that they're kind of known as copyright trolls, and particularly they were famous for the fact that they would claim rights to the party's domain name, the infringer's domain name, as a remedy for a copyright suit, despite there being, you know, no basis in statute or case law for turning over a domain name as a remedy for copyright infringement. Now, the reason we're talking about this again is because the Electronic Frontier Foundation managed to get Righthaven's contract with one of these newspapers, the Las Vegas Review Journal, managed to get that contract unsealed. And the reason this is big news is because Righthaven does not actually get a copyright assignment. So the prevailing case law is that if you have a copyright assignment, so, you know, David O'Brien writes something and then assigns the copyright to me, I get all of the rights that come with that, including the ability to sue people for infringements, even if those infringements happened before the copyright was assigned to me. Now, Righthaven, according to the contract, at least the one that was unsealed, and, you know, it's yet to tell if all of their contracts are like that, Righthaven only gets the right to sue. They do not get any of the rights to license, any of the rights to make derivative works, or right to do a public performance of the piece, none of that. The only right they get in the bundle of copyright rights is the right to sue for copyrights, and that raises some interesting questions, not the least of which is whether or not Righthaven would have what's called standing to bring a suit. So I'm going to throw this to the panel now. Any preliminary thoughts? What's your gut reaction to this story?
Well, this is damaging, I think, to Righthaven, certainly, especially if this contract that has been sealed for all this time, if it ends up only assigning a portion of the rights, you know, you obviously have a problem under case law in terms of the standing issue that you just raised.
If the contract says that they only have the right to bring infringement cases, then their argument, which I believe was that they were getting damaged somehow by the infringement itself, doesn't hold water.
Right, and more specifically, and that also relates into the standing issue, is that one of the requirements to bring a federal lawsuit, or rather a lawsuit in federal court, is that you need to show that you've been damaged somehow, that the damage was caused by the defendant, and that you can seek some sort of remedy in this court. And in copyright cases, the remedy is typically going to be something like monetary damages. The problem here is that if the only right that Righthaven has is to sue, then there's really no damage. They're really not being harmed by this action. Because the harm comes from the infringement on, you know, one of these bundles of rights. On one of the rights in the bundle of rights, rather. And the bundle of rights being, you know, right to copy, make derivative works, and public performance, among others.
This is kind of a weird arrangement, because the newspaper basically hired Righthaven as a thug to go and enforce infringement, but it didn't hire them as a law firm would be hired or anything. They were just kind of a third party that would try to assert rights that only the right of pursuing it. I can't say I've seen anything like this before, and it's kind of a interesting approach.
Right. Now, as Dominic alluded to, if the Las Vegas Review Journal had just outright hired Righthaven as a law firm to represent them and go after these people, it wouldn't be a problem. The problem arises because Righthaven is essentially representing itself. Righthaven is asserting its own interest, alleged interest, in these lawsuits. Now, do you have anything you want to add to that, David or Dominic?
Well, we should probably talk about the distinction between the contract and the rights that were assigned, and then I guess the issue of representation. I haven't read the case law, and I'm not very familiar with this issue just in general, but I mean, how distinct are those rights, and could Righthaven basically, or even Stevens Media, come out and say, well, actually, we're hiring Righthaven as a law firm to represent us, and we are directing them to file these lawsuits. How does that change this picture, and how would it change this particular case where this motion has been filed?
Well, to start out with, the cases would then be Stevens Media or the Las Vegas Review-Journal versus copyright infringer, not Righthaven versus the copyright infringer. And I mean, the reason it changes it is because right now the only right that Righthaven has is the right to sue, not the right to license derivative works, license use of the work, license copies, that type of thing. All of those rights, the rights from which damage can accrue, are still reserved by Stevens Media and the Las Vegas Review-Journal.
So in other words, it would completely change this case.
Yes, it would make this case from one where Righthaven is currently, seems like, in the wrong, to one where they would be legally representing a third party, you know, their client, and validly, you know, asserting on behalf of that client all of the rights that the client has in those copyrights. There's one other thing that I thought of recently and tweeted about when it first came to me. You know, I've read a couple of these complaints, and in all of these complaints, Righthaven says that there was a valid assignment of the copyright to them. And I don't know of any world in which a valid assignment of a copyright can, you know, be classified as what happened here. They got a valid, well, an arguably valid assignment of one right, the right to sue, but that's not even, you know, one of the rights that's recognized in, what is it, 106 of the Copyright Act, Section 106?
107.
Gah, 107. Which is to say that in all of these, well, assuming that the, again, assuming that
no, it's
the,
actually 106,
the contract.
Sorry.
Ha!
Yeah, 107 is fair use.
Awesome, okay.
You are correct,
I
sir.
Feel redeemed. What I was saying is that Righthaven has said that there's been an assignment of copyright in all of these complaints, which are, you know, sworn under an oath. And it seems to be that they have been lying in all of those. Furthermore, if people were reasonably relying on, you know, the assertions made in that federal complaint, that they were at least, you know, to some degree accurate, especially when they concerned, you know, whether or not Righthaven had a valid assignment, does that affect the validity of any of these future settlements? Could somebody go into court and say, listen, you know, we were defrauded by Righthaven, who said that they had a valid assignment, but clearly didn't have an assignment of copyright. They had a contract that would allow them to enforce certain rights, none of which would grant them standing.
Can you even split the rights like this? Can, like, you outsource the right to infringe and give people the right to sue? I mean, certainly they didn't represent, like you said, they didn't represent that they had just the right to sue on the basis of infringement. They represented that they had a full copyright interest in it.
I think you can definitely split, you know, most of the other rights of the Copyright Act.
But
this isn't a right.
Too. I mean, they can be broken up a lot.
Yeah, but this, like, let's take this out of the realm of copyright. Say David punches Ben in the face. Can Ben then come to me and say, hey, I'd like to sell you my battery interest. You can pursue on my behalf the battery that David inflicted upon me. And if I'm not an attorney,
no.
I don't see how that works.
So I could do any number of things that approximate that. For one, I could, you know, enter into some sort of contingent fee arrangement with Dominic as my attorney, you know, if he was an attorney in this case, saying I will give you all or part of whatever you get for me as a result of this. I could make up a contract with Dominic that says I will give you all of my rights, you know, all of the earnings for this lawsuit, but I would still have to be the plaintiff in that case. And, you know, that's what I see as the crux of the problem here. I would still have to be the plaintiff in the case because that harm came to me. It didn't come to Dominic. I can't think of a case where I could literally assign my right to bring the suit to somebody else. There are limited
and
cases.
I'd have to be
Dominic. Right, to bring the case. There are limited numbers of cases, usually in civil rights cases, where you'll see, you know, let's say I've got a friend who's mentally disabled and unable to assert his own rights in court, even, through a lawyer. I could, sometimes bring a case, kind of on behalf of my friend, saying, this is what's happening to my friend. He can't represent himself and can't get a court-appointed guardian for some reason. Can we still bring this case with me, with my friend's consent, representing his interests? That's really not what I see here.
There are situations, though, in which you could become a successor in interest, though, to a copyright just by way of an assignment. So, for instance, if there was a company gets acquired by another company, and there was a infringement that had occurred in the past for the first company, the one that gets acquired, then that the acquirer can then still bring the action. I mean, it's not it when you start to break up the right, I think, like they've tried to do here, is where you really run awry. But you can
Right,
correct me
and
if I'm wrong
it's.
then.
No, I totally agree with you. The problem, the distinction between what you said and this case is that in the case where you have it, the at least one of the enumerated rights in the Copyright Act, or some subset of the enumerated rights, would still go to the person who, was the successor in interest of the copyright. Here, there's no enumerated right, or even subset of enumerated right, that actually flows to Righthaven. It's just merely a token of, you, Righthaven, can bring these lawsuits. You don't actually have, any permissions that come with the Copyright Act.
Right, and that I guess that just all ties back to the standing issue.
Yeah, I just don't see that Righthaven has standing to sue as an owner of the copyright, because I don't think they have ownership of the copyright. They only have ownership of a limited right to sue for infringement of the copyright, but they don't own the copyright or don't have a license to use the copyright.
Right. See what I did there?
Haven. See what I did there?
Well played, sir. Well played.
So what then happens to all these people who already settled with Righthaven in the past,
Yeah,
based on the assumptions that they had a valid interest?
that's what I was trying to bring up. I don't know. My guess is some of them, depending, some of them may sue Righthaven to try to get the. Well, some of them may politely go up to Righthaven and be like, "Hey guys, remember when you lied in your complaint that said that you had an assignment, but clearly you didn't? Maybe you could give us our money back." Some of them may sue. Some of them. I'm not entirely sure. There may be some avenue whereby they could try to reopen the case, but I don't know. That would depend on how the case was dismissed, whether it was dismissed with or without prejudice, and by which parties.
If there's fraud involved, they might be able to, but otherwise, if there's not, like,
Well, potentially you
I
have a
don't.
breach of contract, assuming that the settlements were constructed as contractual arrangements.
Yeah, it depends on the terms of the settlement. If
Yeah,
Righthaven
and
was clever, they phrased it in a way that even if they didn't have the copyright that they claimed they had, they'd be fine. As long as they
but it
don't
sounds like
represent
they
that they
didn't
have.
really know what they had. I mean, if you look back at all of their pleadings, or the ones at least that are listed on the EFF's website, it seems to suggest that in almost every case they've asserted that they are the valid assignee to a copyright from Stevens Media, and that's just frankly not the case.
You think that they didn't know that? Really?
I mean, the CEO of Righthaven is a l lawyer at a pretty reputed firm.
Reputable.
Yes.
Yeah, anyway, I can't imagine that whoever drafted these complaints did not know that there wasn't an assignment of copyright.
Well, it depends who's drafting it. I mean, of course, it gets signed by an attorney at some point, and then you run into all sorts of professional responsibility-like issues where your conduct might sort of become such that you could be sanctioned under the certain court rules and stuff. But it's possible you have to admit that maybe Righthaven itself, like I, for instance, I in I couldn't possibly imagine signing a document for a court and actually asserting that all the allegations that I set forth in this document are true if it says something like we are the valid holders of a complete assignment of copyright, not just like a of a single interest in the copyright of the entire copyright, and that ends up not being true. So frankly, I find it surprising that they lay this out in some of the allegations, and then this document surfaces that's been sealed for all this time, and it appears that they don't have a full assignment.
If it's true that I'm taking what you say, David, is true, that they did not know that they didn't have a full assignment, then that's just incredibly poor legal work on whoever drafted this contract with Stevens Media in the first place.
Mistakes happen. I mean,
that's a big mistake.
Stupidity. It is, but yet we're here right now, and we're seeing this argument filed on a motion that they don't actually have the rights that they say that they had in the pleadings, right?
I don't disagree with you there, and I'm usually the first person to say, it's a cock-up before it's a conspiracy, but I don't understand how you bring literally hundreds of lawsuits without realizing at some point that you don't have what you say you have in the complaint, because they had to re-execute this contract. I imagine they had to re-execute this contract or a similar contract for each piece of media that they got access to.
Yeah, absolutely true. But remember, just a few weeks ago, Right Haven was involved in the lawsuit against Ars Technica, or the Ars Technica freelance writer, Eric Gardner, for writing about the Matt Drudge case weeks ago, or actually months ago. I think it was back in December. He'd written an article about it, and he had reproduced an image that looked like it had been scanned into the original lawsuit that the story was talking about a Drudge lawsuit, and was sued by Right Haven. And then, of course, that case was voluntarily dismissed by Right Haven a few hours after it was brought to their attention.
Right, and it's worth noting that one of those reasons it may have been dismissed is because Stevens Media retained the ability to essentially veto any claim. So each claim that Right Haven wanted to bring, they first had to send past Stevens Media. And Stevens Media had the right to say, no, you cannot bring this lawsuit.
Oh, that's a fair point, too, yes.
Okay, we've talked about this. Unless people have remaining thoughts, we can probably move on to the next story. Dominic, anything?
All set here.
David?
Yeah, all set here too. And on that note, I will take us on to our next case, which involves CBS and CNET. Apparently, they have been named as defendants in a new lawsuit filed against them for distributing LimeWire, which is, of course, the peer-to-peer software that gained notoriety after the Grokster decision by the Supreme Court in 2005 against the Grokster software as a basically a substitute for those software platforms to distribute files and other things across the internet to your peers. The interesting thing about this case, I think, is that LimeWire was sued back in, I believe, 2007 or 2008 originally. Just last year, in June 2010, there was a series of court decisions which came down related to the lawsuit that finally, after the litigation, it kicked around enough. It came down to summary judgment motions, and of course the RIAA side of the litigation won the case. And come last fall, fast forward just a little bit, there was even a permanent injunction that was issued by one of the courts against LimeWire. So LimeWire no longer exists. Now, just following that, and what's actually going on in the LimeWire suit this week, which is notable, is that LimeWire is up for trial for damages, and this case is going on in the Southern District of New York, and that case will likely go on for the next 2 or 3 weeks. Right on the heels of this, though, CBS and CNET are sued for distributing LimeWire, or so the complaint says. This complaint was filed in the Central District of California by a guy named Alki David, and he is apparently a wealthy producer of various types of media and sort of a well-known quantity in the Hollywood world. Is suing CNET and CBS for distributing LimeWire, and in particular, he points to CNET's and CBS's website, download.com, which apparently LimeWire has been available on for some time and continues to be available on to this day, apparently, along with some of the other peer-to-peer software distributions. The premise of the lawsuit, of course, is pretty much akin to the legal reasoning that we saw in the Grokster case, and that's that CBS or CNET is basically materially contributing to or inducing direct copyright infringement by basically users who go to the website, download the software, and then use it to distribute files in violation of the Copyright Act. Now, I guess what's really interesting are some of the numbers that are thrown out in the complaint, and at this point, all we have is the complaint. I haven't even seen any responses from CBS or CNET, but apparently the plaintiffs assert that CBS and CNET were responsible for the download of LimeWire 220 million times, and that accounts for 95% of all downloaded copies of this software. And they also point out that approximately 175 million copies of Morpheus were also distributed on download.com, as well as iMesh, 115 million copies, and Frostwire, 32 million copies. And the way that you get software into download.com, according, again, to the complaint, is that you go to their corresponding site, CBS's, that is, upload.com, and you submit software there where it gets reviewed by some of the staff, either at CNET or CBS, and there's apparently a evaluation process, and then once it's available on the website, there is apparently, according to the website, some sort of pecuniary arrangement whereby the owner of the software pays per download every time that the software is downloaded. There are other sorts of programs that go on with this to promote the download of some of these products, and according to the complaint, all of that together is why CBS and CNET should be held liable for copyright infringement. So, that was a mouthful. What do you guys think? Is this different? What's unusual, I think, about it seems to be that it's an entity other than the marketer or developer of the software. Usually we don't see it a case like this once removed to like a media distributor or a website that has a bunch of downloads available on it.
So he got a couple musicians to join with him, right? Otherwise he wouldn't have had standing to bring this.
I assume so, and that was something I was trying to figure out before we started this show today, was what are the rights that Mr. Alki has? And it's not clear, but there are a number of other defendants that are, there are a number of other plaintiffs who are on the complaint.
One of the other plaintiffs, Mike Mozart, has this rather interesting blog where he starts out with a quote from the Grokster decision, where he says that this is a new form of secondary liability, that one who distributes a device with the object of promoting its use to infringe copyright, as shown by clear expression or other affirmative steps taken to foster infringement, is liable for resulting acts of infringement by third parties. Is that a new form of secondary liability, or is that the same old form of secondary liability we've always known?
It doesn't fall into inducement, because you're not actively encouraging people. So that was, the wording was at least, the way I was hearing it, kind of subtle in that. So inducement says if I distribute it and encourage people to infringe, then, you know, that's secondary infringement. What are the
this says one who distributes.
One who distributes with the intent for people to go infringe, as opposed to somebody who affirmatively encourages people to.
Okay, I see your distinction.
Element of Go, David.
I'm sorry. In fairness, it's this line of infringement, or basically secondary liability in general, has had a lot of tortured syntax associated with it. A number of different formulations have existed or have sort of arisen since the 2005 Grokster decision.
Eric Goldman. Goldman?
Yes, Goldman.
Yeah, Eric Goldman said that this is tertiary infringement. You're distributing something that can infringe copyright, which was in turn made by somebody who encourages infringement of copyright for then somebody to go and actually infringe copyright. And, you know, I think that it can be boiled down to what Dominic said, this kind of new form of secondary infringement. Or, you know, maybe not a new form of secondary infringement, but I don't see how. You'd basically have to say, do away with the substantial non-infringing uses test for secondary infringement, and say that the only purpose of LimeWire was to infringe copyright, not what people have typically been resting their hats on, which is that yes, most of what's going on is infringing, but there's still this subset of works in the public domain, artists who distribute their own work freely on these services. Those are they're not a huge number, but they are substantial, and they're not infringing.
Fair enough. I thought that was actually one thing that the Grokster Supreme Court decision dealt with, and harboring around this, if it has substantial non-infringing uses, that seemed to be something that they sort of threw out. And I believe that case actually says you can have copyright infringement, you can be liable secondarily for copyright infringement, even if a piece of software has substantial non-infringing uses, so long as you were promoting it for the purpose of copyright infringement, that you were aware of it, that you were benefiting from the distribution of it in some way financially. All of those things seem to override the substantial non-infringing uses, because that was an argument that most of the other peer-to-peer software companies tried, I thought.
Right, no, and I totally agree with you, and maybe I misspoke. So to, I guess, walk people down the line a little bit, the when you look at Sony Betamax, the Sony Betamax case, the Sony's argument was you can pretty much only use this thing to infringe. The defendants came back. I'm sorry. Sony's argument was Sony was Betamax. Sony was saying, "Don't make this illegal." The networks were saying, "You can only use this to infringe." Sony said, "Look, there are people like Mr. Rogers who encourages people to time shift their program and, gives some sort of valid consent." And the court said, "Yes, there are. This is solely a device that's sold to people, and it has substantial non-infringing uses. Therefore, we're not going to hold Sony to be secondarily liable for the infringement caused by its users." Come to Napster, Grokster kind of cases, and you have, yes, there still are substantial non-infringing uses, but the fact that they are actively inducing copyright infringement overrides that. Now, the argument that I was trying to make with CBS is that, yes, you have Grokster, and Grokster, induced infringement as a court recently held, but you've got CBS, and CBS is almost like this third-party neutral that's just providing a place to download software. Even if they are getting some monetary gain per download, they're not getting a, as a proportionally, to the best of our knowledge, proportionally different amount from this work that from LimeWire that can is capable of infringement than they are for other software which is not capable of infringement. So you go.
I think you've hit the nail on the head right there, because the issue to me seems to be exactly how much were they profiting from these downloads. And if you go back to the numbers that I spouted off at the beginning of the story, 220 million is what the plaintiffs are saying in this case. And it doesn't disclose what exactly the pecuniary relationship is then between LimeWire and CNET on that per download basis, but I would imagine that it's, something that makes that number 220 million substantial in financial dollars.
And either to complement or refute your point, I'm not quite sure which. I don't think it's the actual monetary value that matters. It's whether or not they're profiting differently between infringing software that can infringe copyright and software that does not, well, does or does not infringe copyright. And this is analogous to the DMCA in that YouTube does not lose its safe harbor just because they've got ads on infringing works, because they've got ads that run by infringing and non-infringing works. If they only had ads on infringing works, then I think that they, could lose their DMCA protection, because they, I forget exactly what the language is in the DMCA, but essentially they'd be profiting differently off of their the works that they host that are infringing, as opposed to the way that they. I messed that up at some point. YouTube is would be profiting differently from infringing than non-infringing works if they hosted ads on infringing works but did not host ads on non-infringing works.
I think your logic is fairly sound there, but as far as I know, I'm not aware of a distinction like that in the case law itself, where it says that there has to be some proportionality difference between infringing uses and non-infringing uses of a particular thing, or in the case of CNET on download.com, whether the amount of downloads for legitimate products that aren't used to facilitate copyright infringement outweighs substantially the infringing software such as LimeWire. So I think that it only seems to require that there be some sort of direct profit or direct financial benefit from the distribution of the software. And so I think that might be where CBS gets in trouble here, but it's just not really clear what that is based on the complaint. Dominic, you've been quiet throughout this. What do you think?
Well, apart from my concern about standing, which hopefully they actually have plaintiffs who were harmed, I don't think they'll succeed with their case. It feels a little too tenuous to me. Like, basically, they're saying that CNET, by writing stories about it, by hosting it on download.com, and somehow profiting from every download, invited people, or I don't want to say induced, but encouraged or made it possible for people to infringe in a way that they wouldn't have otherwise. I mean, CNET hosted a lot of stuff on download.com. Back in the day, I think I even wrote an application and had it hosted on CNET. And yeah, like, I don't think there's a 230 defense for this sort of thing, is there? But basically, pretty much anyone could upload to CNET and have their stuff hosted.
Right, 230, of course, doesn't protect against intellectual property claims, which this would likely fall under, since it's copyright infringement. But you're right. I mean, they do host a lot of software up there, and they continue to host a lot of software up there, including some of these file sharing programs. So that's kind of interesting that even after all of the litigation that's gone on, you kind of have to give a little bit of benefit of the doubt to CNET in that, you know, they've passed this through their legal department. They're aware that, you know, there are these sort of issues around file sharing programs and copyright infringement cases. And maybe it's the case that their legal team has reviewed this and they just think that it's far too tenuous to merit even taking down the software from the store. But according to the complaint, there's sort of this review that goes on of when you try to submit software to the site. And there are a couple different levels to, I think, the accounts where you upload the software. They mentioned basically something that sounded like a basic account and then a premium account in the complaint. It wasn't, I think it said that there was no free accounts, that you had to pay to be a developer that uploaded to download.com. It wasn't totally clear for me, but it seems that, you know, there is some sort of review that goes on. There were these editorial write-ups about the software that basically compared it to past versions of peer-to-peer software. So what I took from that was that the plaintiffs were trying to establish that there was a awareness or knowledge that the software would be used primarily for file sharing and unlawful file sharing at that. But you know, Ben made some good points about, you know, proportionality of comparing what infringing software would be downloaded compared to software that is not used for infringing purposes. And even though that I'm not aware of any cases that make those make those distinctions in case law, you know, you could envision a court, you know, thinking about that a little bit more carefully and maybe delineating a line of case law about that. In any case, I don't think this goes out on a motion to dismiss. I think that there seem to be some factual issues, at least as I read the complaint.
So I'm looking at download.com right now, and on the right column there's most popular downloads for last week, and number 4 is YouTube downloader, and number 6 is free YouTube to MP3 converter. And then further they've got a review of a product called TV Chrome, which apparently lets you watch World TV in your Google Chrome browser. I mean, these all could potentially, in some ways, infringe. I can see how watching television content or ripping MP3s off of YouTube, or making it easy to rip MP3s off of YouTube, could potentially violate copyright.
Right, and I think when you're dealing with organizations that primarily have a news bent, like CNET and CBS, there has to be some element of First Amendment analysis in these copyright claims because, you know, they're providing reviews and information and access to these, you know, programs at least partially as a news service, and what they say about them, whether or not it's considered inducement, may be weighed in one way or the other by whether or not, by their capacity as a news agency, news organization.
That's a good point. And just because some editors reviewed the software and posted an editorial review about it, does not necessarily mean that the whole of CBS was aware that these programs were being hosted on the website. So I'm still not really quite sure what to think. When I read the headline on Ars Technica, I was thinking, like, this sounds like kind of an odd lawsuit. And then when I read through the complaint and giving it the mind that everything that they're stating in the complaint is probably somewhat true, it seemed like there could be enough facts that might bring it under the purview of some of the Grokster case law or the. Do you guys have any final thoughts or want to speculate on outcomes?
I'm all set for now. I don't think it's going to go very far, but it's kind of too early to speculate.
All set as well.
Okay, take us away then.
Our final story concerns the International Trade Commission and Apple and Elan Microelectronics, a Taiwanese company. So back in 2009, Elan sued, I'm sorry, back in 2009, Elan sued Apple over a bunch of patents. I'm not sure exactly what patents they were, but it seems to be just around touch capabilities of Apple software, like the whole touch screen interface, the whole way all that works. They didn't win the district court case and instead turned to the International Trade Commission. And the International Trade Commission took its sweet time, about 2 years, to figure out whether they wanted to look at the case. And finally, when they did want to look at the case, they came out with the decision and said that, first, they aren't going to ban the sale of devices that potentially infringe on these patents, because that was one of the things that Elan has asked for. And second, they found that Apple actually didn't violate the patents at all. This was just an initial decision from the ITC, because the final full decision is going to be in the full ITC instead of just one judge. But this was sort of a preliminary pass to see whether there needed to be a ban on all Apple products using these allegedly infringed patents, and the judge found that no, and second, he didn't think that the patents were violated by Apple. Thoughts, panel?
So good news for Apple.
So the next step here is that Elan is going to ask the ITC for review of the judgment of this judge, because they feel that the judge was incorrect in reaching his decision. Shockingly. So this all falls under international administrative law, which is kind of its own little branch of law. And it's kind of an interesting thing to state because patent law, especially international patent law, now sort of proceeds on two forks. You'll see people in U.S. district courts trying to apply U.S. law, and at the same time, in parallel at times, or sometimes sequentially, they'll go to the International Trade Commission and say, we want to apply international laws that people have agreed to via treaties and try to attack from both sides, thinking that, well, if I can't win in the US, I'll at least have a chance internationally, or vice versa. Basically, you get two goes. Go ahead, Ben.
Are there two different ITCs? Okay. My understanding was that the ITC was part of the Commerce Department.
It's part of the Commerce Department. Why does it say International Trade Commission, huh? You're correct.
Because it's okay, but it applies not U.S. law in its determination of whether or not the patent the I mean they only execute these things on U.S. patents.
Well, what they're doing is they're apply yeah, but they're applying trade remedy laws, basically. They're applying basically what happens is you need to be a foreign entity and you say that, hey, I'm trying to do trade with the US and this company is infringing my patents, which, is inhibiting my ability to do trade. I'd like you to slap them on the wrist or give me money or some other sort of solution. And it's one of the intricacies of patent law right now that there's sort of two paths that you can attack. You can go through the ITC and you can go through district court.
Right, the advantage of the ITC being that ITC decisions come much faster, and it's a lot easier to get what in it is in effect an injunction in the ITC. So most ITC ITC cases take a little over a year, somewhere between a year and 16 months. Meanwhile, a patent suit in district court can stretch out, easily 4 years or more. The other thing is, in district court, it's after the eBay case a few years ago, it was a Supreme Court case, it's become very difficult to get injunctions in patent cases. Meanwhile, the ITC will prohibit imports because the ITC has jurisdiction over import and export. The ITC can prohibit the import of any goods if they, if one of these proceedings finds that it violates a patent. And there are some other requirements, but those are less important right now.
Yeah, to bring us back to this particular case, what the administrative law judge found was that Elon didn't have significant licensing activities of a particular patent to satisfy the domestic industry requirement. In other words, they hadn't tried to license this patent enough or hadn't licensed this patent enough to actually show that they were part of the domestic industry. Second, that Apple didn't prove that the patent itself was invalid. And then third, that Apple products didn't actually infringe the asserted claims of the patent, which still leaves Elon a window in that the patent hasn't been found invalid, which is pretty big. It just is that Apple hasn't been found to infringe the patent, which is also pretty big. So I managed to pull the two patents in question, which are capacitive touchpad integrated with key and handwriting functions, and multiple fingers contact sensing method for emulating mouse buttons. Ben, were you saying something?
I was just going to talk briefly about the domestic industry requirement. One of the things that's required to bring a case in the ITC is that the patents you're asserting are part of some domestic industry, and that can be either manufacturing, research and development, or to some degree licensing of those patents in the United States. And that's a quality that's kind of in flux as to how much or how little industry you need here to support that, but essentially, the ITC is a is was set up to protect U.S. industries from foreign imports.
So, can you concurrently have cases going on in a U.S. district court and the ITC?
Yes, in fact, Elon actually does have that going on right now. They're suing Apple in the Northern District of California for infringement of the same two patents, and Apple has countersued Elon. And that district court trial isn't scheduled until February of 2012. So, as Ben said, district courts take their sweet time.
Yeah, it's also not unusual to stay a district court case pending the resolution of the ITC case.
So yeah, what then is the effect of either an ITC decision or on a US District Court case or a US District Court decision on an ITC case?
As far as I know, there's no preclusive effect one way or the other. It will probably, since the ITC case is, more likely to resolve first, it will, probably have a what's the word I'm looking for? Settlement effect, in that it may encourage one party to settle or not. But the ITC is made up of, it's an administrative body and has administrative law judges, so there's, at least to the best of my knowledge, no precedential effect on Article 3, which are, regular courts.
So, besides speed, what are there any other direct advantages to go to going to the ITC when you have patent claims against somebody else?
Yes, as I mentioned before, effective injunctions. So, like I said, ITC has jurisdiction over things that are imported into the United States. So you can, while it's difficult to get an injunction in a in the district court, it's easier to get that injunction or again, effective injunction in the ITC. You could prohibit imports of any infringing goods through the ITC.
Yeah, so the biggest advantages of ITC is that you get an answer faster, and you usually can get preliminary relief even faster, and you can get, as Ben said, general exclusion orders and stop all the imports, which is kind of huge. And the standard, the threshold necessary to prove that, is lower in that you don't have to go through the eBay factors that you would have to go to in district court. The downside is that you can't get damages in the ITC.
One other thing that I'd like to note, because there was a lull in the conversation, is that because the ITC has jurisdiction over the imported good itself, all of their cases are something along the lines of in regard to convertible exerciser patent litigation, or in regard to several computer microchips. So they have fun names that are not usually, Apple v. Elon.
Yeah, it's certainly an evolving area of the law, because more and more parties are turning to the ICC for this sort of parallel litigation, and people are kind of frowning on it because it's kind of a pain to defend two lawsuits at different places in some sense. So it's probably an area of the law that'll see some change in the next couple decades.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see whether or not Congress steps in and does anything with the evolving definition of what a domestic industry is, or what other changes may happen. That being said, I think Congress has its hands busy with other things right now.
Anything else on this story?
I'm all set, David.
I'm all set too.
Right, in that case, thanks for listening to our 100th podcast. I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm Ben Snitkoff.
And I'm David O'Brien.
If you have any thoughts, ideas, comments on how we can do a better podcast, feel free to email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org, tweet us at techlegal, and please visit us online at www.technicallylegal.org. Have a great week.
Woohoo! Episode 100! Which puts us four away from 2-year anniversary.
Yeah, not, I mean, 2 year, it's not quite 2 years because we've taken a couple of weeks off, but it's very close.
Wow, time flies.
Indeed.